The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Welcome to the Seneca Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. SubChina is simply the best way there is to keep on top of all the important news coming out of China, especially if you subscribe to our daily email newsletter, SubChina Access. And visit subchina.com to check out our wide range of reported pieces, our op-eds, videos, and of course, podcasts. It's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, coming to you today from my home in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Joining me from Nashville, Tennessee, is a man who clings to his vintage pleather clutch purse and Playboy brand belt buckle like his Trump-loving neighbors cling to their god and their guns, Mr. Jeremy Goldcorn. Jeremy, I should add, is now shorn of that fulsome thicket that once sprouted obscenely from his face and neck and is quite dapper looking, I have to say. Jeremy, a new Jeremy, greet the people.
Hello, people. Yep. No chance of getting a COVID-free barber in this part of the country at the moment, so I had to just do a hack job.
Go all the way down.
Yep.
Yeah. Anyway, let's jump in. What do you do when the world, you know, is coming to an end? After this awful year, thankfully, now almost over, I can't say it's a question I haven't been asking myself.
And if you were a resident of the old international settlement in Shanghai 80 years ago, facing the reality of Japanese occupation and a tenuous existence on the Gudao, the lonely island of the international settlement, the answer might very well have been, go to the racetrack and bet on the ponies. Our friend James Carter, Jay, has written a marvelous and highly engaging book about the city of Shanghai, featuring a diverse and fascinating cast of characters, all of them reckoning with the end of their world. Jay focuses on the last time that the Champions Stakes, he'll explain what that is momentarily, that the Champions Stakes was run at the Shanghai Race Club, just 3 weeks before Pearl Harbor on November 12, 1941. It's a really good book, and I highly recommend it.
Indeed, indeed it is. Jay is professor of history at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia, and he's also the author of one of our favorite columns on SubChina, I think I speak for both of us, which is called This Week in China's History, which he's been contributing since it was June of this year. And he's covered stuff from the Tiananmen protests of 89 to the Boxer Uprising, from the Taiping Civil War to a Sino-Russian basketball game in 1926, and from the McCartney mission to the arrest and sentencing of Uyghur intellectual Ilham Tohti in 2014. It's a wonderful column, and we're extremely grateful to Jay for contributing it. Jay Carter, welcome to Seneca, and a belated congrats on the book.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure, and in 2020, pleasures are hard to come by, so all the more appreciated.
I'm going to laugh a little too long at that. Jay, I am curious because horse racing is something I knew next to nothing about before reading your book. I never read Seabiscuit, and I have never even been to a racetrack, let alone watched a horse race at a racetrack. So what did you know about horse racing before you started researching this book?
I can't say that I knew a ton about horse racing. I mean, I was a casual fan of racing, and like many folks in the U.S. anyway, I'd pay attention to the Kentucky Derby, and then depending on how that went, maybe some of the other Triple Crown races. So I wasn't a big racing fan. I was a big sports fan. And in fact, I spent some time paying a lot more attention to motor racing when I was a kid growing up. We had a track in the town I grew up in.
Where was that, Jay?
I was in Connecticut. So it's not the kind of place where we associate with stock car racing. But yeah, there was an old track, which has since alas been turned into a mall. But in terms of racing, I really came at it from the attraction to sports, and then the idea that sports was a way that you could see different people from different places coming together and doing their thing. And so, well, that caught up with my day job as being a China historian, and all came together at Champions Day.
So I'm curious. I mean, it seems like an unlikely vehicle for telling the story of Shanghai during the Nanjing decade and its denouement. But I have to hand it to you. I mean, it really worked. And I should hasten to add that the book has all sorts of historical asides. It's not, you know, merely focused on the race. The race is the, you know, kind of the trunk. But there are all sorts of branches that are offered there, you know, for context and more. And they stretch back as far as the 18th century, and they cover, you know, the Opium War and the Taiping Rebellion and all sorts of other stuff. But so how did it occur to you to make racing and the Shanghai Race Club really the focus of the book? How did it strike you as, like, the right vehicle for this?
Well, okay, so I've been doing this now for 20-plus years, and over the course of as I was looking for a new project, it dawned on me that what I was really writing about and really mostly teaching about and researching was the history of relations between China and the West, and I'd done that in a number of different venues. So I wrote about the city of Harbin and the aftermath of the Russian Revolution, wrote about a Chinese monk who was founding temples in these sort of semi-colonial or colonial cities. And I found that if I was going to write about the history of China and the West, there's really no better place to do that than in Shanghai. And so when I spent my first trips to Shanghai, I looked around the city. I hadn't been there. I'd been in China for more than a decade of working mainly in the north before I ever set foot in Shanghai, and found this big, big oval in the center of the city, People's Square, which of course isn't square. And as I poked around, I discovered that that had been the racetrack. And just looking at that, it seemed to be the perfect kind of physical place that was at the center of the city. And as I started looking into it, it became clear that there was not only a physical center of the city, but it was really a cultural, a social, and economic center of the city as well. And so that just seemed like a natural, given my proclivities toward looking for a good sporting story to tell, that all came together, and it seemed like the place where it was all going to happen. But how I came to settle on the one day is yet another, kind of another aspect to that, which we can get into if you want.
Well, let's get into it. What was the significance of the Champion Stakes and of Champion's Day?
So, as with any historian, I'm always, you know, trying to fight the urge to push us back further and further into the past. So, when I started looking at writing about just a single day, which I had in mind just as a narrative device, just to make it structured on one day, but I realized that one day wasn't going to make a lot of sense unless people had some understanding of why that day was significant. So the Champion Stakes began back in the 1850s and 60s with the founding of the Shanghai Race Club. And initially there were two seasons. I mean, there were always two seasons, but there were also what they called extra race meetings, which would happen throughout the year. But the two seasons were in the spring and in the fall. And the highlight of each season would have been what was called the Champion's Stakes. And that would have been a race among all of the winning horses from that season. So it was really the best of the best. It was the Super Bowl, the World Series, whatever metaphor you want to put onto it. And so that would happen twice a year, once in the spring, once in the fall. And it would be a holiday in the international settlement. Most of the businesses would close. You would pack people in to come watch the races. You would have, depending on the year, anywhere between 10 and 40,000 people that might show up at the track to watch the races. And it's important to note that from the very beginning, most of those crowds were overwhelmingly Chinese. So even though the club was founded by Brits and it was run by foreigners, most of the people who were at the races for any of these races would have been Chinese.
Yeah, and as I was reading the book, I came to suspect that there's kind of a double entendre in the word race that was the real foundation of the work. Race meaning both, you know, a contest of speed on the one hand, and race also meaning this kind of socially constructed way that we group human beings on the other. Let's talk about race in the book, starting with this. Did you worry that while writing, you might be paying too much attention to the transnational colonialism facet of Shanghai and not enough to the Chinese who were, you know, in the audience, as you say, and made up the majority of race goers?
Absolutely. I mean, that was something that was really, and really at the heart of the book, was trying to get a true picture of Shanghai. And to give a true picture of Shanghai, that had to be one that acknowledged the importance of these transnational colonials, but also acknowledged that the city, even in the international settlement, was well over 90% Chinese. So what did it look like, and how did that environment come together? And so I tried to do it in kind of a handful of different characters. And as we've talked in the past about, there's just a bunch of different characters that come together. Certainly the protagonists in many ways are these white men and a couple of women who own the horses, Cornell Franklin, who's an American, Arthur Henchman, who's an Englishman, Bob Aitkenhead, who's a Brit. But they are just a part of the story. And so in many ways, what I found is that the energy that Shanghai manifest is really coming from Chinese, the Chinese people, and that includes the Chinese who are at the track, but also you have this other elite level of Chinese who, I mean, you talk about the social construct of race, they're not permitted to really be full members of this Shanghai elite society because of racism. And yet, in every other way, they illustrate the kinds of lives that the wealthy Americans and Brits were living. So people like Dao Yudun, the architect, people like Ying Tang, who's an actress, people like Nate Swong, who's a newspaper editor and publisher. So these are people who are all in the same space. And so I was really trying to be conscious of the fact that, yeah, the artifice of this whole story, the race club, was a kind of racist institution that was representing imperialism, not just representing it, but acting out imperialism. And yet the environment that was there was one that was partaken of by people from all across the ethnic, social, economic, cultural strata of Shanghai.
Jay, a related question. You push back a bit on the idea of Shanghai as truly cosmopolitan. And, you know, I think this reflects a very different sensibility writing about it now than might have been the case for a writer even perhaps 20 years ago. You write specifically at one point that white men held too much power to call the city truly cosmopolitan, for instance. Of course, historical writing reliably, you know, illustrates as much about the times that a writer lives in as it does about the times that he or she is actually writing about. And you obviously read an awful lot about this period, written either contemporaneously or in the half century since the war. So how would you characterize the difference in the way that you approach the topic from the way people of an earlier generation did?
No, that's a great way to put it. And I'm always very conscious that history gets to, you know, it's a tripod, right? You've got the past, which, with apologies to science fiction, can't ever change. It happened once, it's not going to happen again. You've got the present, which is where we're stuck. We can't be anyplace else. And then you've got that third leg.
Woe is that.
but don't worry, there'll be a new present coming very, very soon. And then there's that third piece, which is your sources. And so all those three pieces interact to give us, that's why history is constantly changing, even though the past always stays the same. So right. In terms of how I'm looking, what I'm looking at it, yes, absolutely. Issues of representation, issues of understanding, you know, romanticizing the colonial period in Shanghai is really troublesome. You know, as our friend Jeremiah Jenny put it, it's kind of icky. and so there is a real problem with trying to get at Shanghai because you have to wade through this sort of colonialism without romanticizing it. At the same time, I think that in the communist era, you've got a historiography that comes out about Shanghai as being really one of Dante's circles of hell because it's just defined by exploitation and by cruelty and by all sorts of to quote Jeremiah again, ickiness. But I think that, you know, all those things are present together. And I think if we leave them, any of them out, we do a disservice to our understanding of the past. And so Shanghai was a place that had, I mean, gosh, it just had so much energy that was there. And a lot of that energy was used for ill, and a lot of that energy was used for good, but it was all energy there that we need to, if we're gonna be honest with it, with ourselves, we need to take all of those parts, the positive and the negative.
I think that's really where your book succeeds. I mean, it does something pretty difficult. I mean, that's not an easy needle to thread, if you ask me. A lot of reviewers of the book have pointed this out, including our own Alex Smith. She reviewed the book. I'm sure you saw it. It was on our site. And she talked about how you complicate some of the narratives around Shanghai and about China. And, you know, we've just talked just now about how you complicate that kind of, you know, modernist cosmopolitan narrative. But also, you know, Shanghai as the epitome of Western imperialism. I mean, it's not that either, right? I mean, you managed to push back on the whole narrative of, you know, just colonial exploitation. But, you know, still, you don't downplay the realities of, like, the May 30th movement, or, you know, the Shanghai massacre that precipitated that. or, you know, the realities of racial discrimination. So what's your, do you have a rule of thumb? I mean, this is something that I think listeners to this show, a lot of them, you know, try to write about China, and it's a difficult thing to do. What are the rules of thumb you rely on when you try to navigate this? Or do you just have sort of an innate instinct that's just been honed by time and experience? How do you approach this?
I don't know if there's a rule of thumb. I mean, I have to say that my editor at Norton, I mean, she pushed me really hard, and the book is immeasurably better because of her input and some of her colleagues who kind of looked at things and come at it from a different angle. Because I guess the rule of thumb is to never be comfortable, because anytime something seems like that it's unproblematically great, that probably means that there's a problem in me, that I'm not understanding what the problem is. And at the same time, if it seems unproblematically bad, that also means we need to dig a little bit harder to get at what's really going on. So I don't know if I have a rule of thumb, except that if things seem to be too easy, it means that they probably are, and that we need to do better.
That said, it struck me that writing about the Shanghai Race Club was in some ways a perfect way to get at the kind of complications we've been trying to talk about. Can you tell us about race and the Shanghai Race Club and about the International Recreation Club and how it was created in response largely to the exclusion of Chinese from the Shanghai Race Club?
So the history of racing in China, now, of course, Chinese people and people in East Asia, whether they were part of what we now call China or not, they've been racing horses for a long, long time. But the notion of horse racing that we might recognize on our TV screens come May, is something that comes from with the British. So almost as soon as the ink is dry on the Treaty of Nanjing, you have race courses set up in Shanghai and in Hong Kong. And in fact, the two never quite come to agreement as to which one was first. Hong Kong was probably first, but don't tell that to the folks in Shanghai, at least at the time. So these race clubs, I mean, they did. They sprang up alongside imperialism. So they come up in all the treaty ports. By the peak of all this in the 1920s, you had race clubs in multiple cities and several cities, including Shanghai, Beijing, had more than one racetrack. So in Shanghai, the issue was this. The people who founded the race club in the 1850s wanted to replicate England. They decided to do it in a way that was racist and imperialist, and they did so by excluding non-white members. So you had to be white to be a member of the Shanghai Race Club. Now, that didn't mean you had to be white to go to the races, but it meant to own a horse, to be a member of the club, you had to be white. And this went on for a little while, and then at some point, some of the folks in the, and I use the word loosely, some of the gentlemen in the club, they determined that they didn't want to even have any non-Europeans in the grandstands at all. So they made it that you could, to attend, you had to be a member. And of course, since to be a member, you had to be white. That meant that there were no Chinese there. So two things happened in response to that. One, and most kind of most positively, the Chinese members, the Chinese horse owners, because they're wealthy Chinese in Shanghai, and they founded their own track. They went and founded a new track up in Jiangwan, which is to the north up near where Fudan University is, and has another part to play in the Champions Day story. But they started their own race club, which wound up being financed, in fact, by Europeans. And so the membership was mixed. And then, in fact, a third race club gets founded out near where the Yangtze enters into the sea. And that one excluded Europeans. So it was a Chinese-only race club. So
the Yangtzepu.
The Yangtzepu. Now, the thing that happened back in the race club is I said two things happened. The other thing that happened was that the Europeans recognized that actually this wasn't very much fun, having this without any people there, because the crowd was so diminished. And so then they changed their policies to admit people of all races and nationalities into the grandstands, though never into membership in the club. So that year, that period when they were excluding Chinese altogether lasted just a few years. But the consequences, I think, were serious, because they made the people kind of a little more cognizant of the hypocrisy that they were advocating in trying to have this whites only institution in the center of 90% Chinese city, So I guess we could call that colonialism.
Yeah, for sure. Oh, so we've talked about the people in the stands, the people in, who own the club, who own the horses that raced. But what about the horses themselves? I mean, they talk about the, you know, the Chinese ponies. These are these all the sort of short-legged, really kind of small ponies that you see in Mongolia? Or were you allowed, for example, would you, if you brought in an Arabian? I mean, it doesn't seem like it would be a very fair race, right?
No, and this was constantly at the people worried about this all the time. So just your first question. So yeah, these ponies were pathetic looking, I think, by the standard of most horse owners today. They weren't thoroughbreds. Yeah. They weren't even properly horses. They were these Mongolian ponies, which, if you've seen these Przewalski horses.
Yeah, Przewalski's horses.
So
yeah.
That's what they really looked like. They were kind of short and kind of broad and kind of shaggy.
Many horses.
Yeah, they were. They were small. And you see pictures of the owners leading in their horses. Oftentimes the owner is standing taller than the horse. And so people who came in from out of town to watch the races, they were at first kind of taken aback by this because it seemed a little bit, not quite as dignified as they were expecting. but you did have you had thoroughbreds who were imported from Australia usually, but they had to run separately. And so, okay, and because right. there's a continuum, I mean, when is a horse no longer a pony? When does it edge over into being a little too big? So anytime a horse was too big, there were all these rumors that it was really a hybrid and that wasn't purely what were called China ponies. So yeah, there's a lot of controversy over that. But in Shanghai, they doted on these horses. They loved these little China ponies, shaggy and fat though they were.
I've ridden them before in Mongolia and in other places. And I mean, the canter is the most unbelievably uncomfortable thing. And to get these things to gallop is just a pain. It's just...
I can't imagine.
The canter is just like... I mean, you're just like going up and down. Like, I mean, it's insane. It's luckily, you know, I've had a life in metal, so I'm used to that kind of banging of head.
Bashing anyway. Your head.
Yeah, exactly. Jay, the book is fundamentally character-driven, though there are quite a number of characters, I mean, a huge range of characters. It might be a good approach. I mean, you flicked at some of these, but let's go through and name some of the more colorful characters and have you offer us maybe little potted bios and a couple of anecdotes that capture who they were. Let's start. You talked about Cornell Franklin, an American from the South, and his wife Estelle, who are some of the people that we, you know, followed throughout the entire story. And that's pretty interesting. I mean, I think there's a great little aside you can talk about, you know, Estelle and who she ends up marrying.
Yeah, yeah. So that was one of those, you know, when you're doing research and things turn out. Yeah, so Cornell Franklin was American, and most of the foreigners in Shanghai were British. But Cornell Franklin was American. He's from Mississippi. He really did, in his law school yearbook, it said, you know, he was most likely to become a millionaire, and I guess he succeeded. He wound up becoming a judge in Hawaii before it was a state, and then wound up going to Shanghai. So he was really interesting. He lived in these three very racially segregated environments, living in Mississippi, then living in Honolulu, which was a very segregated city as well, and then going on to Shanghai. So when he gets there, his wife, Estelle, she writes very colorfully in some unpublished short stories about just the alcohol-fueled haze that was enveloping white Shanghai. And she was very unhappy there. And eventually she winds up leaving, and she takes these trips back to Mississippi, which keep taking longer and longer. And eventually she divorces Cornell and marries her childhood sweetheart, who you may have heard of. His name is William Faulkner. and in fact, stays married to Faulkner for the rest of his life. I mean, she is his companion for most of his life. He marries again, and it's his second wife, Dallas, who is with him at the time of Champions Day. And his main competition are two men I also mentioned, but the one who kind of focused the most on is Arthur Henchman. And Henchman was the manager of HSBC. So if you're familiar with Shanghai, you'll see the big HSBC building with the big dome on the Bund. And so his corner office there overlooking the river. And even though it was just a branch of HSBC, it was the most important branch, and so the headquarters was in Hong Kong, but the most important branch was in Shanghai, and all these people were coming together to to brag with one another, to better one another, to compete with one another at the racetrack.
Yeah, so the three of them were sort of the three competitive horse owners who rode in Champions Day, and so in some sense they're the three protagonists.
Yeah, so the third one was Bob Aitkenhead, who's a Scottish engineer.
Right.
But they're all owners. So at this point they weren't riding horses. The jockeys are another really interesting angle on the story.
Wouldn't they initially it was the owners who rode though, right? I mean, up until like the 1910s.
It was. Right until the turn of the 20th century, and even later than that, a few. But yes, originally it had all been, you know, a very gentlemanly sport. You'd own your horses, you'd ride them. But by the 20th century, it was more professionalized.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Let's talk about Wang Niger, who was a pioneer in developing rather strange English names for Chinese people. His English name is Nates Wang,
yes.
N-A-T-E-S. One of the major intellectuals of the day, foreign educated, fluent in English. He wrote regular columns and in some ways really captured the zeitgeist of Shanghai in the Nanjing decade. Tell us about him.
I loved Nates Wang, and Wang Niger, and he went by Nates, and I got corrected numerous times, you know, in copy editing because, you know, clearly I had an extra S in there. It's like, nope, Nates Wang is correct. So Nates Wang, you know, he's the kind of person who I really, this is where it's a little bit limiting to be an historian, because I really wanted to have him as a more prominent character. I just scraped together all the sources I could about him, and I couldn't, you know, I couldn't figure out when he was born. I couldn't figure out when and how he died. But for about 10 years, I had a pretty good track of what he was up to. So he was a magazine editor, and he was a translator. He was an actor, and he was present in the International Settlement. He was living right near the racecourse in the International Settlement. The place that you saw him the most in the historical record was, and you all may know this from different conversations, but there are these great archives of the Shanghai Municipal Police. And so he was interviewed by the Shanghai Municipal Police in 1938 because he had written, he had not written them, but he, as publisher, had published some articles that were considered too critical of the Japanese. And this is where the politics get very complicated. So the British, who are running the International Settlement, well, at this point, Shanghai is now completely surrounded by Japanese armies. And so the British are quite sensitive to the fact that they're really only able to stay there because the Japanese are allowing them to. They know there's not a whole lot they can do about it. And so when Nates Wang publishes these anti-Japanese screeds, that raises the ire of the British police, who tell him in no uncertain terms that he needs to cut it out. And so you get these cross currents of nationalism, because obviously the Japanese are not at war with the British. They're kind of cooperating, but they're kind of antagonistic to one another. China is occupied by the Japanese, and yet you've got this free city of Shanghai, which is only free because it's occupied by colonizers. And that just kind of gives some sense of what a mess it was to be in Shanghai in the late 1930s.
Indeed, indeed.
Jay, you also write about the playwright S.I. Xiong, or Xiong Shi, who was also educated abroad. He wrote a successful play called Lady Precious Stream, featuring one of the big names on the scene at the time, a clothing designer and entrepreneur named Ying Tang, who is apparently also a very talented actress. Can you talk about the play and about Ying Tang?
Yeah, so S.I. Xiong's play, Lady Precious Stream, is something that, it's one of those, I mean, I don't know what the current example of it, almost by definition, I don't know what the current example is, but in the 1920s and 30s, well, 1930s, this would have been an enormously important piece of art. It was played in London to rave reviews. It was considered to be really one of the most important examples of cross-cultural interaction. So it was written by a Chinese, he wrote it in England while he was there, went to go study, do a PhD in literature. And it was based on an old Peking opera, and it was then produced in Britain, and then it was produced in Shanghai, where it was, the starring role was played by Ying Tang, who, as you said, she was a socialite, she was a fashion designer. Her father was a doctor who tended to both Chinese and English patients. And so as a result, she wound up performing the play in Shanghai, but then she got an offer to go to play it on Broadway. this is one of the most interesting parts of the book to research, because it was one of the places where I had both a Chinese record, Chinese language record, and an English language record that were talking about the same things and to get their different perspectives. And both sides were very excited about the prospect of this play, which was then going to be produced in New York. And it was going to be a product of China and of the West and of Shanghai. They were really excited because it was going to illustrate Shanghai. And then it fell apart. So it still went up in Broadway, but Ing Tong didn't play the lead role for reasons that seemed to have something to do with her divorce. Now Lady Precious Dream, I mean, it's still performed now and again. If you Google it, you can find usually student organizations doing presentations of it. But it certainly is something that before I started researching this project, for instance, I wasn't familiar with it. And I think that's common to most people in my situation.
Right. The modern equivalent is the Three-Body Trilogy. It'd have to be.
is that going to fade from our memory quickly?
No, it's not going to at all. But, I mean, it's the same thing. It's Chinese work that's been sort of feted in the West and is now being made into a Netflix series and that sort of thing. Right. There's a lot in the book about urban planning, about architecture, about a very deliberate effort by people in Shanghai, whether they were Chinese or foreigners or something between, to create a synthesis. Actually, I think that's one of the book's big themes, is this idea of blending or hybridity, and it shows up a lot. But let's talk about, you mentioned the district of Jiangwan, the area north of Suzhou Creek near where Fudan is, and the ideas and the individuals that are behind that district. It's not really something I'd known much about before, and I'm now really eager to see what's still there. So talk about Dong Daiyou, Da Yudong, and his vision.
Yeah, so Dong Daiyou is the person who, you know, so many of the people in this book are what are now very commonly known as anti-heroes, because they're people who are they're the protagonists, but you can't really root for them because they're mostly kind of nasty. Dong Daiyou is an exception to that. He is, I have no problem calling him my favorite character in the book. So he was born in Hangzhou in 1899. His father had been in the foreign service, or was in the foreign service, so he spent his childhood abroad in Rome and in Japan, which are both really interesting places for that time in terms of architecture. There's interesting kind of modernist stuff going on, especially in Italy. Anyway, he's educated. He comes back to China. He's educated briefly in Beijing, before going to university in the United States, in Minnesota, actually. So he graduates from the University of Minnesota and then winds up studying architecture, and after a brief time in New York City, winds up going back to Shanghai. And when he goes to Shanghai for the first time, going back to China. And so when he gets there, he winds up being one of the main practitioners of this style that was, along with this American Henry Murphy, this style that was meant to sort of revive, it was kind of called Chinese Renaissance or maybe Ming Revival. So it was an architectural form that was meant to revive a kind of Chinese classical architecture. But it was, of course, you know, this, we can't overgeneralize and say like there's Chinese architecture. It's really this kind of Ming monumental architecture. And that was what he did to try and bring that into Nanjing. When you saw the building of many of the new capital buildings when they moved the capital there for the Nanjing decade. And in Shanghai, something a little different goes on. So in Shanghai, it's a combination of these sort of Chinese Renaissance buildings, which are meant to clearly demonstrate that this is a Chinese counterpart to the foreign-dominated buildings down on the Bund. But at the same time, it's not trying to be frozen in time. It's not trying to be locked into an Orientalist kind of fantasy. That you have this very Art Deco, very modernist attempt to bring things together. And if you go up there to Jiangwan, still many of these buildings are there. One of my favorites was the building that was to be the aeronautics ministry for the new government, and it was shaped like an airplane. If you look at it from above, it's very clearly an airplane. But there's also a big stadium that was being built there. There's the library and the museum. Those are all being built up there, and a lot of those were started in the early 1930s, and by 1937, when the Japanese invade, many of them are ruined. Not most of them are destroyed, but many of them are ruined, and a lot of them have now they're still there. Tina Kanagrantanam and Patrick Cranley at Historic Shanghai, they lead walking tours out that way, and they tell me that there's a lot worth seeing up there.
You know, I've got to get there and I've got to do one of Tina's tours. That would be fantastic. I really don't know that era in Shanghai is, or architecturally, I just don't know it as well as I ought to.
There are some great.
I can't wait.
There are some great books on Shanghai architecture right now that are out. I can put them in the show notes. But there's some terrific stuff going on.
Yeah, you just send them over to me, and I'll definitely put them in. You don't really judge the inhabitants of the Lone Island too harshly for their choices in the waning days, for focusing, you know, all their attention on something that others might find entirely frivolous as, you know, the end of Shanghai looms. But I can imagine that some people might see this as, you know, critiquing Nero's violin technique or commenting on the final arrangement of the deck chairs on the Titanic. How would you respond to that kind of potential criticism?
Oh, I think that's completely fair. No, it absolutely is. You know, what they were doing was purposely distracting themselves from one of the great crises of humanity, of what was going on in the late 1930s and early 1940s in China. I mean, they were only 200 miles away from the Rape of Nanking. And so they were, you know, they were mainly concerned with whether or not the races were going to be delayed by the Japanese invasion. So those actions were just despicable. I mean, there's no way around it. At the same time, it is something that happened. And so I think that way I would respond to answer your question directly is that what I'm trying to do is kind of have it both ways a little bit. So I think that there's a lot of readers. If this book succeeds, a lot of people who will read it will be the first book about Chinese history that they read. And so I think it's kind of a shiny object. And the shiny object that is horse racing and kind of colonial society and all these things that people look at, and it catches their attention because it's got this kind of style that is like a Netflix original series, and you see it and it kind of gets people's attention in the same way that the fabulous clothes in Mad Men can attract your attention, and then the horrible actions of Don Draper, we kind of get in and we start to interrogate what he's done, but we're attracted right. by the visuals. So I think that what happens in Champions Day is, if you look at what's going on there, I think it's a really arresting story, and I really do think there's a story there that's worth understanding. And then when you get into it to try to tell people, like, no, right now, I mean, literally right now in 2020, like, the West is still trying to come to grips with just how god-awful its behavior was for such a long period of time. And when you look at Shanghai today, I think that energy that you can, when I was researching and was writing, the energy that I could feel in Shanghai in the 1930s and 40s, that energy is still there in Shanghai. I mean, Shanghai has an energy that's common to many of the great cities of the world, but there aren't that many of those great cities in the world. But I think now the difference is that the rules are being made by Chinese, by China. They're not being made by the West anymore. And I think that trying to come to terms with that process, that move by which the people who had for so long lorded over so many people around the world are now having to come to terms with how they behaved. I truly don't know that the Western world has come to terms with just how much it has to atone for. And so that may be too much to put onto the back of a China pony going around the racetrack. But I do think it is. I think it's a way to get people's attention and to say to them, there is something here that needs to be understood. And I think that it plays out in a lot of different directions.
Jay, before we wrap up here, let's talk a little bit about one of my favorite parts of editing SubChina at the moment, which is your column, This Week in China's History. You've been writing it for us for half a year, I guess. I think all of us at SubChina really enjoy it, and we've had great feedback from our readers. For an academic historian, it strikes me that you're really good at writing for a popular non-specialist audience, which is not something that I can say for many of your colleagues.
Or most.
I'm a polite person sometimes. Is this something you've always known you were good at, Jay, or has it been something you've had to work at as you've been writing this book and doing other projects?
I mean, you teach a lot of undergrads, right? I mean, that might be part of it too, right? You're not like You don't have a lot of grad students.
Yeah, I do. And Jeremy, if you will allow me to parse your that discourse a bit and perhaps deconstruct the
parse
problematic
the
at the of your question.
No, just when you had me impressed, Jay. No. Okay, parse the discourse.
No, I think that...
parse this.
Parse this, Jay.
I think Kaiser put his finger on it. I think that I teach mainly undergraduate. I mean, teach entirely undergraduates. I don't have any graduate students. I've sat in on a couple of doctoral committees over time at other institutions. But I have teach undergrads, and so I do think that that's really my mission. It's my career. It's my mission. It's what I do. Is trying to communicate to other. To communities who aren't academics. I mean, most of the people I talk to aren't people who study Chinese history professionally. And that's got a big challenge to it, but it is an opportunity. And it's one, that, I mean, the Sup China column has been, I mean, I'll say it's been a lot more work than I expected it to be. It's been much more rewarding than I expected it to be because I get a ton out of finding these stories, trying to find the right balance. This has been the really hard part, trying to find the right balance of things that are kind of trivia, but trivia with an angle to it that makes it to be more than trivial. And then other things are sort of some of the big events like the McCartney mission or the Boxer Uprising, things that everybody, quote unquote, everybody knows about, but maybe they don't understand them in quite the way that professional historians do. And so then I think, Jeremy, I think there's a compliment in there. I think the point is trying to take what professional historians kind of argue about and distill that down to be like, okay, why does this matter to somebody who is just out in the world, and how would it be interesting and worthwhile for them to learn about it?
That's really well put. I mean, that's exactly what you've done with this column, is that you take some of the sort of big historiographic arguments or some of the controversies that are in academia and you make them quite intelligible. I cannot recommend this column more highly. You are one of a number of historians out there who are sort of in the same project. I definitely cite Jeff Wasserstrom as another one who is a great popularizer. Who are some of the other people who you'd point to who you think do this particularly well out of academia?
I'm trying to think of now who, I'm trying to think of the different hats that people wear. I mean, so you took Jeff off the table. So Jeff Wasserstrom is one of the people who does a lot. There's other people who write really well, and it's just a question of getting, you know, people have to get the right audience. Kelly Hammond, who's at the University of Arkansas, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. She's doing some really interesting work, especially to do with Islam and the role of Muslims in the 20th century. It's in World War II that she's writing about right now. Darren Byler, who's another Sup China contributor, writing
Absolutely,
historian who does,
yeah.
I mean, and is writing about the Uyghurs. Jim Millward is another person who focuses a lot on the Uyghurs who does stuff and is a professional historian. The person who I find reading, who I really look forward to reading a lot are people like Yang Cheng, who's not a historian, but nonetheless she takes a lot of really sort of sophisticated ideas and communicates them to a broad audience. Rana Mitter.
Ron
is another perfect example. So there's a lot. I mean, Jeremy's points are well taken. And if I were not talking to him, I would probably take up that position because I have very little patience for when I listen to somebody talk and I have to look up the words that they're using when there's a perfectly good word they could have already used. But I do think that it's a bit of a straw man to talk about how, you know, academics are talking and, you know, they're in the ivory tower navel gazing. Because I think that there's a lot of people who are out there really trying to engage the public. And I think a lot of them do it really successfully. Kevin Cruz doesn't do this for China, but doing this for like American history. He's one of those people who's out communicating with, fighting with Dinesh D'Souza as well. So there's a lot of people out there.
A lot of people fighting with Dinesh D'Souza for sure. There could always be more, though. Let's just cannot stand that prick. I just cannot stand that prick. My God. Jay Carter, what a pleasure having you on the show at last. You have been such a friend to us, to Seneca and to Sup China. I'm glad we could finally do this. So let's move on to recommendations. But first, really quickly, I do want to remind everyone that if you like the work we're doing with Seneca and the other podcasts in the Seneca Network, then the best thing you can do to help us out is to subscribe to SubChina Access for just $88 a year. You get a wealth of news on China delivered to your inbox every weekday. We've got, I think we're running, aren't we running some kind of a deal, Jeremy?
Isn't it yes.
Like some half price thing?
There's a special festive season deal which you can find on our website on our Christmas shopping list.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Check out our...
Well, sorry, I'm in America now. We can't say... Well, we can say Christmas. What are we supposed to say?
Holiday
season.
Shopping.
Holiday. Hanukkah. Diwali. Ramadan. Right, Christmas shopping list.
All right. Recommendations. Jeremy, kick us off. What you got?
So something to depress you called Black Wave, Saudi Arabia, Iran, and the Rivalry That Unraveled the Middle East, a book I'm about three quarters of the way through.
Really, I read it. It's great. Yeah, yeah, she's terrific.
The author is Kim, I don't know if you say Gattas or Khatas, and it's a horrifying history of how the last 40 years of geopolitics in the Middle East has led to the situation that what was once perhaps the most cosmopolitan part of the world is today what it is.
I recommended that very book on the show before. I guess you didn't listen
to
that
did.
Episode, Jeremy. That's okay.
Oh, right. No.
I think it's definitely worth a second recommendation. Black Wave is great. Yeah, Kim Gattas, fantastic book. I mean, yeah, as you say, very depressing, but very relevant in light of Saudi Arabian complicity in the recent assassination of Iran's top nuclear scientist. And, of course, they were complicit. I mean, come on, Netanyahu and Pompeo both met with the crown prince just like days before the assassination. So, hey.
Since that's been recommended before, let me hit you with a piece of escapism that is absolutely delightful. A writer called Lawrence Block, a new discovery for me, recommended to me by my father. And he has a series about a hitman called Keller. The first one is just called Hitman. And it is the most wonderful stuff. You find yourself absolutely, you know, sympathizing with this character who is a hired assassin. And it makes it easier to contemplate the world than reading Black Wave, I have to say.
All right. Hitman. Yeah, Jay, what do you got for us?
I'm gonna cheat, as seems often to be the case, and give you two, just because I've been reading both of them and I couldn't decide which one to choose. So one is one I think you may have recommended already, so it can be quick, which is so Gordon H. Chang's The Ghosts of Gold Mountain.
Yeah.
That's you know, the story of Chinese immigration and the railroad, but I more than any other book, I think it really illustrates what was going on and how that kind of migration paralleled so much of what was going on with European migration to the East Coast. And I think, I mean, so Kaiser, you grew up, well, I guess you're from Buffalo, but you grew up in the West Coast, right? Spent a lot of time there.
Binghamton,
sorry. Now I put my foot in it. But I know that, you know, I think on the East Coast, there is such a bias toward Europeanness having come into with immigration, and I think that this Ghost of Gold Mountain really gave me an understanding of how those two immigration movements, the movement from Asia and the movement from Europe, what commonalities they have, what differences they have, and it's just beautifully told. So I would really emphasize Ghost of Gold Mountain.
Yeah, and that's Gordon H. Chang, the good Gordon Chang, not that other Gordon, the bad Gordon Chang.
I will leave that to you to say. Yes.
Gordon G. Chang.
And then the other book...
Well, there's the Gordon Chang with a very bad track record of predictions. You could call him that instead of the bad...
broken clock is right twice a day, right?
Yeah, I know. It probably will be pretty soon.
The other book that I've been reading and I'm just really enjoying a ton is, maybe you're familiar with, it's called The Floating Coast by Bathsheba DeMuth. So Bathsheba is a professor at Brown, but it's called... The subtitle is An Environmental History of the Bering Strait. And so it's looking at that whole area of what she calls Beringia, so Alaska and then the right. Soviet Far East, the Russian Far East. And it's an environmental history, but it's also, you know, it goes from the Cold War to the fur trading, the way that climate change is affecting that whole region. And it's woven together with personal stories that it's rare because of the way that it does something that I value really, really highly, which is to take these big historical processes and make them real with individual stories. And I think, so The Floating Coast, it's published by Norton. It was out last year. I think 2018 is when it's published. But it's a terrific book.
your book is published by Norton, is that correct?
It is.
Yeah, so you're just like plugging Norton books.
I'm plugging.
They paying you for this?
Well, Ghost of Gold Mountain was not, so there we go.
Okay.
I'm sure they're paying massive payola for these history these book podcasts. Tips. Yeah.
Exactly. If you get me, yes, get me a mention.
I'm going to recommend the four albums by the great progressive rock band Porcupine Tree that began with In Absentia in 2002 and spanned to the Incident in 2009. So it's In Absentia, Dead Wing, Fear of a Blank Planet, and The Incident. Porcupine Tree has a lot more in their catalog, but these are the four just absolutely indispensable records from this band. I have to thank our friend and loyal supporter Ed Sander in the Netherlands, who's just a huge progressive rock aficionado like I am. He's deeply into Porcupine Tree and the solo stuff that their frontman Stephen Wilson has put out in the years since. Ed has actually interviewed Stephen Wilson on quite a few occasions, that lucky son of a bitch. He's also sent me lots of cool rarities. So if you're deeply into Porcupine Tree, hit me up. We can talk about this stuff. I actually listen to this almost every night as I play ping pong with my wife. And she's actually learned to like it too. She doesn't object, although she describes
it as a long-suffering wife.
I know, right? But she says that Porcupine Tree and a lot of the other music I listen to, she describes it as Li Gong Nan Yinyue. So I guess that would be tech boy music. I'm not sure what that means.
Science nerd music, more like
it. Yeah, it is sort of nerd music. I'll take it, though. It's just great stuff if you're into that. I mean, it's Jeremy, you should check them out. I think you would actually like them. I know Faye would.
Yeah. Sounds good.
It's great music. Anyway, Jay, man, thanks so much. That was a great book. I'm really, really glad I got a chance to read it and to talk to you about it.
I really appreciate being on, and it was a pleasure. It was a pleasure. That's all I can say. As I said earlier, pleasures are hard to come by in 2020. So I will take it doubly.
Take them when you can,
Jeremy. As always,
indeed.
All right. The Seneca Podcast is powered by SubChina and is a proud part of the Seneca Network. Our show is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldcorn with editing help by Jason McRonald. Drop us an email at seneca@subchina.com. Follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at SubChina News. And make sure to check out all the shows in the Seneca Network. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Take care.